You're listening to the Ray Hanania Podcast, a weekly overview of all my opinion columns, my radio interviews, and my reports on Middle East topics and on mainstream American politics. My Middle East columns are published in the Arab News newspaper, the Middle East Monitor online, and the Arab Daily News online. My mainstream columns are published at suburbanchicagoland.com and in 7 newspapers in the southwest region of Chicagoland, including the Regional News, the Reporter newspaper, the Des Plaines Valley News, and the Southwest News Herald. This podcast also includes my radio show broadcast in Detroit on the second Friday of every month, live on WNZK AM 690 radio, and also live online. It's a lot of information and a lot of resources, but you can get all of this on my writings and podcasts by visiting my website at hanania.com. I hope you sit back and enjoy this latest podcast. This past week has been a busy week. There's been a lot of topics that I've been writing about, and there's been a lot of news. A lot of things have been happening. The Chicago mayoral elections, Rahm Emanuel, the mayor who held the office for 2 terms, decided to retire. Good riddance to him. He wasn't a bad mayor, but you know, when it comes to mainstream topics, he wasn't a bad mayor, but he hates Arabs. I mean, and being Arab American, I can't like a guy like that. I don't really care. Because Americans are part of this country. And if he doesn't like it, he can lump it. I at least served in the U.S. military. What did he do? He probably worked for the Israelis in their military and not for ours. So am I glad he's gone? I could care less about him. But we did have a very tough election in Chicago with 14 candidates who were running. And it was the outcome, I think, was a little more surprising than people expected. We're going to talk about that. There's also this continuing outrage over Jussie Smollett, who was an actor with the TV show Empire, the cable show. Now, I don't watch Empire, and I'm not interested in it, but I'll tell you what, he grabbed the headlines when he alleged that he was attacked by 2 racists and homophobes who made fun of the fact that he was gay, that he was a racist. They supposedly recognized him, you know, from being in Empire, which I find hard to believe. I didn't have any idea who the guy was. He wasn't one of the main actors in the show. And he was, you know, downtown, I think, in one of the neighborhoods up there, maybe street or ville or wherever. And he was out late at night, and he said these 2 guys jumped them and attacked them, called them names, and they wore a MAGA, you know, hat, you know, and he's basically attacking Trump, you know, the red baseball cap, make America great again. And then he said that they put a rope around his neck, like lynching him. Now, that's a terrible story. All those things are horrible. You know, gays have a right to live any way they want. Nobody should pick on them. African Americans are the victims of racism. And we need to stand up to racism. They're not the only ones that are victims of racism, but we do need to stand up to racism in all its forms against everybody. I totally agree with that. And the idea, though, that somebody would try to lynch an African American in today's, you know, world just kind of, you know, lit a fuse, you know, playing into this, what I think is this political propaganda from the left. You know, where they're trying to use race and all kinds of stuff to attack Donald Trump. So, without getting into Trump, we can do that another time. It just was one of those stories. But what was amazing about it was Smollett decided to do an interview with Robin Roberts of ABC's Good Morning America. And she softballed the interview with Smollett. She basically enabled this guy to say whatever he wanted. You know, when you have a sympathetic journalist, especially one of the top journalists on the top-rated morning shows like Good Morning America, you're going to feel empowered to say whatever you want, because the disgust in Robin Roberts' face, and she's African-American and she's gay, so she identifies with him. It's not the most objective interview in the world, pretty biased in my opinion, but she enabled this guy. And then it turned out days later, because the police were investigating right away. Now, when I first saw the news, I saw the pictures of the two suspects. They didn't look like white racist thugs. They looked like they were African American. And they turned out. And the other thing was that he said that he fought with them, but he still hung onto his sandwich that he bought at Subway, and he still had his cell phone, but he left the rope around his neck. And I'm going, okay, that's really weird. And then I got even more suspicious when police said that Smollett released some of his cell phone information, but he personally, through and with his lawyer, redacted the majority of it, pretty much hiding a lot of the information. So how do the police investigate something when he doesn't want to be completely forthcoming? So right away, those raised red flags. It wasn't because he was black. It wasn't because he was gay. It was because the facts just didn't make sense, and he wasn't cooperating. And sure enough, about a few days later, the Chicago police announced that this was a hoax, that he organized, that the two suspects that he identified from video turned out to be friends of his who worked with him on the show Empire in even smaller bit roles, who he offered and paid $3,500 to do this to him because he wanted the publicity. And it turns out that he had sent himself a threatening letter to Empire, but nobody paid attention to it the week before. So he figured, hey, he's going to step it up. He'll hire two guys, do this whole thing, and what, is he an idiot that no one's going to find out that this was a hoax? Oh my God. So that was depressing. But you know what really bothered me is you can't talk about race without it turning into racism. You know, I'm white, I'm Arab. A lot of white people don't consider Arabs white. A lot of blacks don't consider Arabs black. So I'm kind of stuck in the middle. But it really upset me that many African Americans were jumping to his defense before and after, without holding his feet to the fire on something so explosive and politically agitating. You know, he turned this into an attack on Trump. And I'm not defending Trump here. I'm just saying that this was a political attack that he made. And nobody pushed back on him. Are you kidding me? And now it's almost as if, well, you know, they're attacking the Chicago police, whose police chief is African-American, by the way, and who denounced Smollett for doing this, considering all the things that were going on. Now they're attacking the police, saying, well, the police, why did the police waste so much resources doing such a detailed investigation? In other words, what they're saying is, why did they go to that effort to expose him as the fraud that he is? And they're more concerned about defending Smollett rather than the fact that this man set back race and homophobia maybe 100 years. The idea of lynching somebody is so disgusting that the next time some act of racism happens, a lot of people are going to sit back and wonder, is it true? So real victims are going to be punished by it. That was one of the topics, and I wrote about that at my website at suburbanchicagoland.com, and it appears in some of the newspapers that run my syndicated column, like the Regional News, which is actually the best. I get so many email responses, by the way, from readers of the Regional News newspaper in the Southwest suburbs. I'm really proud of that. It also appeared in the Southwest News Herald, I believe, and also The Reporter. Sometimes my columns do and do not appear in the Des Plaines Valley News, especially, I think right now, they're involved in some local politics and stuff. So that was one of the big ones, but you can always go to my website at hanania.com, where I archive everything that I write, the podcasts and everything. The two Middle East topics we can talk about a little bit later, but and that one of them was Rami Malek. I don't know if you've ever seen Mr. Robot, but he was the main character in that, and he also played Freddie Mercury in the movie Bohemian Rhapsody. Now, the song Bohemian Rhapsody is just phenomenal, and so it's not like they had a lot of great movies in 2018. There were a couple. But I think this is one of the worst years in the past 5 years. But Bohemian Rhapsody is such a great song. No matter what the movie is about or how it, you know, whatever the details, I'm probably going to like it because I love the music. But Rami Malek is Egyptian-American. His parents are immigrants. They immigrated to this country legally. They were not illegal immigrants. There was and is a legal process where immigrants can come to this country. Even now, they can come into this country. But it's become such a big political thing. But he made a point of pointing out how his parents were immigrants from Egypt, and how he was first generation born here in the United States. And it's a big deal because he's the first Arab American to win the Best Actor category Oscar. And that's phenomenal. So I wrote about that in my column in the Arab News. And you can go again to thearabnews.com, or you go to hananiah.com. You get the link directly to all my columns. And I talked about him. You know, when you're Arab in America, there's a good chance you're going to face several hurdles in your life. Politicians exclude us. Sections of the news media stereotype us. And mostly the media only covers us as a negative story when we do something bad. When we do something good, they don't really write about it. And the majority of movies, and I've studied this, and there have been books written about it, like Jack Shaheen, the author, in his book, Real Bad Arabs, R-E-E-L. Real, get it? Bad Arabs. Talks about how Hollywood has brutalized and stereotyped and demonized Arabs in these movies. There's some 200 plus, maybe almost 300 movies. And I've documented many of these in my databases. So we get beat up. And the worst, of course, I think, the one that's not, no one pays attention to when it comes to anti-Arab racism in this country, is in the book publishing industry. 80% of all these fiction books, Patterson, I could go through all of them, you know, James Patterson, all these books that he writes and others, there's always a bad Arab character, a Middle Eastern terrorist somehow, and there are very few positive Arab characters. So, and that's my argument. You know, the Italians will come in and they'll say, hey, look at the way they portrayed Italians as mobsters. Well, that's true. That is terrible. But Hollywood and the publishing industry and the media have also portrayed the positive sides of the Italian-American community. And they do that with every community. They present the good and the bad. But with the Arabs, they only present the bad. You never see a movie or a book or some popular entertainment that profiles Arabs. When you do, it's very rare, and it's played down. So that's where the racism comes in. They marginalize us. They only focus on the negative. They never balance it off with the positives. And that's why I was real proud when I saw Rami Malek win, you know, the Best Actor Oscar. That's a phenomenal achievement. And it made me feel good. It reminded me, though, and I wrote about this in the column, too, back in 1978 when Vanessa Redgrave won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress in her role in Julia, the Holocaust movie that year. During her acceptance speech, Redgrave applauded all her colleagues. She vowed to fight against racism, fascism, anti-Semitism. And then she made a comment that referenced a bunch of protesters who were protesting outside of the auditorium where the Oscars were being held. These were members of the Jewish Defense League who were protesting and denouncing her because she also had produced a documentary called The Palestinians. Now remember, this is 1978. So in her speech, she denounced the, quote, bunch of Zionist hoodlums, unquote, who were protesting. And I remember back in 1978 watching, and I jumped up and I'm yelling and screaming and cheering and going, yeah, Vanessa Redgrave, somebody standing up to defend Palestinians. And of course, immediately after her speech, she got kind of booed. There's a link to that in the column, I believe, to the video of her speech, which you have to see. It just took so much courage. And then as soon as she said, they cheered her when she spoke about fighting fascism and anti-Semitism. But when she mentioned the bunch of Zionist hoodlums, there was like this, oh, like shock and awe throughout the Academy Awards. You know, 6,000 people in the movie industry are not. I doubt if there was one Arab in the whole bunch. You know, that they had. So it was really shocking. And of course, Paddy Chayefsky, the racist American playwright who happened to be Jewish, attacked her. This is a racist whose movie, one of the movies that he produces called Network, one of the most anti-Arab movies in Hollywood. He got up there and he basically told her to shut up. Well, you know what? Of course, Chayefsky's not alive, and I don't want to kick a dead horse in the face, but he's such a jerk back then. It's hard not to think badly of what he did because he wasn't fair. He was part of that protest, I believe. So that's what this column was about, talking about Rami Malek, this moment of pride for Arabs in America and why it was so important, and connecting it to the fact that Vanessa Redgrave had really and jeopardized her career in standing up for the rights of Palestinians and Arabs in that 1978 acceptance speech for Best Supporting Actress for her role in the Holocaust movie Julia, which she, by the way, did a great job. She suffered for making those comics. But, you know, Rami, it was nice that he referenced the fact that he was Egyptian-American, but I would love to have seen him make a political statement about how Arabs are victimized, demonized, and oppressed in the Middle East and here in the United States. And I know some people say, well, don't make the Oscars political. But you want to know something? Every Oscars Academy Award presentation has had some politics. So why? Are we not allowed to have any of that? I disagree. My column in the Middle East Monitor is a really tough column because it talks about a report that just came out from the United Nations Human Rights Commission that said that Israeli soldiers had violated international human rights and humanitarian laws in killing 189 Palestinian civilians and wounding more than 6,100 civilians who were protesting every Friday along the Israeli border and the Gaza border. Now, the Israelis, they have this massive PR machine. So, and they basically say whatever they want to say because the Arabs don't do any PR at all. They're just terrible. The Arabs are horrible. Even the Arab activists, we know how bad the media is, yet we don't understand how powerful the media can be if we engaged in the media, if we took control of the media, if we influenced the media the same way that the Israelis do. But we don't do that. I was one of the first Palestinian-American columnists and reporters at a major beat in the United States back in the late 70s and 80s through the early 90s. And that was a big deal, and it was rough for me then. I think I got hired, they thought, you know, at the Southtown and at the Sun-Times, I think they thought I was Italian-American, not Arab. Maybe they thought I was Puerto Rican. I don't know. I would have been proud to be both. But every Friday, these protesters in Gaza have been protesting against what they claim is Israeli oppression and the Israeli embargo against the Gaza Strip. And basically, this embargo prevents basic essentials like food and electricity and building supplies and clothing from coming into the Gaza Strip. Israel really controls it. They have a tight grip on everything. It's considered, basically, Gaza is like an outdoor prison surrounded by the Israelis. Even on the Egyptian side, the Egyptians work with the Israelis because the Egyptians get money from the U.S. and they don't want to lose it, so they have to kind of suck up to the Israelis to keep all that money coming, you know, their way. So what happens at this border, the Palestinians started protesting back on a Friday, I think it was March 30th of 2018. March 30th marks Land Day in Palestine and Israel. Now, Land Day is a date when in 1976, the Israelis announced that they were going to take land from Palestinian Israelis inside Israel. They're going to take Palestinian-owned land, and this was on March 30th, 1976, and Palestinian-Israeli citizens, these are Arab Israelis, started protesting. Now, it wasn't violent, but they were protesting. And it was 1976, and, you know, it was still tense. The Israelis had occupied the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, and there were all kinds of tensions back then. But the Israeli police, in confronting the protesters, shot and killed, using live ammunition, 6 unarmed Israeli Arab citizens, and they wounded 100 other Arab protesters who were protesting the Israeli government's efforts to take and confiscate Arab-owned land in Israel and set it aside for the use only of Jewish citizens in Israel. Of course, that's apartheid and that's racism when you discriminate against anyone on the basis of race or religion. You know, we expand racism and apartheid today to include discrimination on the basis of religion and race combined together, because that's what's happening. So they massacred all these people back in 1976. So these Palestinians in Gaza, who've been under this Israeli brutal, oppressive embargo for I don't know how many years now, maybe 11 or I think since 2005, maybe even longer. They were protesting, and you got to understand how this is all set up, because this tells you the basis of the UN accusation that it's a war crime. The Israelis are along their border, which is, there's a big fence, electrified fence, and it has mines, and they got, it's a wide area, I think of about 100 yards, you know, and the fence sits right in the middle, and the Israelis are about 50 yards from that border, and they sit behind these heavily armed bunkers with these sniper rifles that can shoot a mile, okay? They can shoot anybody. They can pick them off and kill them a mile away with some of these high-powered automatic sniper rifles. So they have hundreds of these Israeli sniper rifles sitting along the border, and it gets boring all day. Every Friday they were doing it. The Palestinians are 300 yards away from the border fence. On their side, they didn't cross over. These Palestinian protesters, you know, were protesting, yelling, screaming, calling the Israelis names, you know, doing whatever. They didn't have guns. They were throwing, some of them may have been throwing rocks. But what the Israeli snipers did was they singled people out and shot them in the head. They targeted the civilians and shot them in the head and killed them. And according to, and they did this every Friday, even in the face of the protests of killing all these people. I think that when you look at how many people were killed, I have to look at the numbers here. I think it was like 38 of them, 35 of those 189 Palestinians were children who were at the protests. They were killed, shot in the head. What, how does an Israeli sniper accidentally shoot a kid in the head, 35 of them? One, you'd think, okay, maybe. But 35 children were shot in the head. Several paramedics who were treating the injured. These are just the ones that were dead, okay? And there were hundreds of other children in the 6,100 that were injured. But 35 children were killed, dead, murdered by these snipers. Several of the paramedics, the nurses and the doctors who were treating these people were singled out by the snipers, these Israeli snipers, shot in the head, shot in the back, and killed, and several journalists and disabled people. The Israelis don't care. They're Arabs. The Israelis, you know, many Israelis look at Arabs as animals. The same way people in the South in the 50s used to look at blacks as animals. That's the way they treat them. And it's exactly the same in Israel today. But in the, at least we protested for civil rights here in the United States and tried to stop it. But in Israel, for some reason, Americans, you know, they've been brainwashed. They're not very educated. Americans, they're the most educated people in the world, but the least educated about the world. So they just shoot and nobody cares. So these protests have been going on every Friday since March 30th, 2018. And last week, the United Nations Human Rights Commission, remember it was the United Nations that recognized and created Israel in 1948. No one else did it. It was the UN with the support and muscle of the United States and a few other countries. They've been protesting, and the United Nations Human Rights Commission issued this report that said that that the killings may constitute war crimes or crimes against humanity, and they argued that the evidence that they put together through this lengthy investigation should be submitted to the International Criminal Court for prosecution. Now, I totally agree with it. Now, if you go to the Middle East Monitor, you can read this column and get some of these facts. You know, these are the things that, you know, the media doesn't want you to read about. They don't want you to know what they've done. But I also listed how this wasn't just an aberration in Israeli conduct. You know, the killing of Palestinians by Israelis has been going on for years. April 9th, 1948, they massacred the civilian residents of this village called Deir Yassin. And the reason I bring that one up is because Deir Yassin, after they massacred the residents, 100 of them, the Red Cross said it was about 250, but Israel never allowed anybody to go in and investigate the massacre. A lot of the bodies were thrown into the village well. The place was cleaned up. They probably just buried or burned everybody. But then the Israelis, what do? They take this village where they massacre at least 100 Arab civilians, women and children, half of them. And then they create this Holocaust memorial called the Yad Vashem. And they built that in 1953, which houses millions of documents on the Nazi genocide of European Jews. And it's kind of hypocritical. They put this memorial to the massacre of Jews by the Nazis on top of the site of a massacre of Palestinian and Arab Christian and Muslim civilians in this village in Deir Yassin, murdered by Jewish Israeli soldiers on April 9th, 1948. I also talk about the Israeli attack on the city of Lydda during the war in July 1948. This is after Israel was declared on May 14th. And this is Lydda was near Tel Aviv. 35,000 Christian, Muslim, Arabs were forced out of the city. And Yitzhak Rabin was the general who implemented that assault, which killed hundreds of residents and pushed all these people out. And the intent was ethnic cleansing. That was later acknowledged by the Israelis that, yeah, you know, we didn't want all these Arabs living next to the center, near Tel Aviv in the center of what was our new state. So we had to get rid of them. So they chased out 35,000 of the city's Arab residents. I think there's like 1,000 or 150 or something, some small number that was left. Then I talk about all these Kabiya in October 1953, murdered by Ariel Sharon. You know what's interesting is these murderers, like Yitzhak Rabin, he becomes the prime minister of Israel. This murderer, Ariel Sharon, he kills all these 40, you know, they kill, I think, 69 unarmed civilians, two-thirds of whom were women and children. Ariel Sharon murders them as a general. He doesn't get prosecuted. He becomes an Israeli prime minister, too. It's almost like in order to become an Israeli prime minister, you have to kill Palestinian civilians. They go through this whole thing. So you can get the link to that on my website, also at hananiah.com, or you can just go right to Middle East Monitor and read the column for yourself. There are a lot of links at hananiah.com. You can see all the different links to the different papers because they're, you know, I love to write about mainstream issues. I love politics. That's my main thing. And I also love, you know, the Middle East and the media, especially from the aspect of media bias. I'm not picking on Israelis or Jews, but I am writing about Israel's government. I can criticize the conduct of Israel's government because I think that's legitimate. Criticism of Israel's government is not anti-Semitism, but that's what they want you to believe it is because they don't want you to hear the criticism. So when the criticism is made, like what I'm making, they say, oh, he must be anti-Semitic. No, I'm not. You know, but if that's your only response, then it just proves to me that everything I'm saying is right because they're not addressing the facts of what's happening. But you can get these facts by going to my website at hanania.com. Now, you know what? I did cover Chicago City Hall from 1976 as a freelancer, and then I actually got assigned there full-time in 1978 for the Daily Southtown. Actually, it was the Southtown Economist, and then it became the Daily Southtown later that year. And that was Mayor Michael A. Blandick, who was mayor at the time. So I went down there. Nobody else wanted to go to cover City Hall because it was boring. You know, really, it was boring back at that time. And right after I got there, as a full-time reporter at the City Hall press room for the Southtown, it just kind of exploded with news because Blandick fired one of his cabinet members, Jane Byrne, who was the commissioner of, weights and measures. And she ran for mayor and beat the machine, and she became the mayor. So I covered Jane Byrne's administration. And right away, her reform flipped, and she became part of the very cabal of evil men that she attacked. You know, politicians do that. They attack. They say, oh, this is a cancer, this tax is bad. And then when they get into office, they embrace the cancer and they embrace the taxes. Because you want to know what? The politicians, 90% of them are driven by power. But I'll tell you what, in all fairness to Jane Byrne, I think the media was unfair. That was one of the first times that Chicago City Hall had erupted in this disruptive political atmosphere. And she became an easy target. And I know that I was a little critical of Jane Byrne, too. But in looking back, I think Jane Byrne did a lot for the city of Chicago. And she's never gotten the kind of credit that she deserved for all the things that she did, despite all the disruptive politics that not always her fault. I mean, Richie Daley, the son of the late mayor, Richard J. Daley, wanted to become mayor and had worked with her. And Edward Doliak convinced her that Richie Daley just wanted her job, but Edward Doliak told her, I don't want your job, I just want to keep my power. So Jane Byrne flipped from working with the reformers like Rich Daley and Bill Lipinski and a few others, and went back to Edward Doliak and John DiArco and Fred Rohde and a few of these other guys. And she put the very cabal of evil men that she attacked in charge of the city council. After the reformers stumbled through, I mean, partly it was their fault, and she couldn't depend on them. They weren't very good in parliamentary procedure. It was embarrassing, you know, to see Lipinski and Obermann and these others trying to do stuff in the city council. They had the right issues. They just didn't have the talent to do it the right way. So I covered Jane Byrne, and when Jane Byrne lost, when Rich Daley ran and Jane Byrne ran, and Harold Washington, first African-American mayor, he won in 1983. I covered him. And then after Harold Washington died 5 years later, I covered his successor, Eugene Sawyer, Mayor Sawyer, and then the rise of Richard M. Daley, who held the office for 22 years until he stepped down 8 years ago. And he was succeeded by Rahm Emanuel, who refused to talk to me because I'm Arab American. Rahm Emanuel is Jewish American. And I really thought, you know, maybe this would be a guy that would understand the needs of Arabs. But he didn't. You know, Rahm Emanuel's father was a member of the Irgun, which participated in this massacre in April 1948 in Deir Yassin, the one that I referenced earlier. In my report on at the Middle East Monitor on the United Nations Human Rights Commission report. Rahm Emanuel's father was a member of the Irgun, and I think that that's settled deep in the family, and he just can't accept and recognize any Palestinians or any Arabs or anybody that criticizes Israel. Anyway, he decided to retire. He had 8 years was enough. Okay, and he wasn't a bad mayor. I tried many times to, you know, reach out to him, to talk to him. I defended him. I actually endorsed him, believing that, you know what, I fundamentally racism and hate start someplace, but you don't have to condemn everybody for these things. You might be able to change them. You leave the door open, and that's what I tried to do with Rahm Emanuel, but you know, during that 8 years, he rebuffed every effort that I made to talk to him. I've interviewed every mayor that in Chicago, even Richard J. Daley. One of my first assignments as a reporter or freelancing was to cover a press briefing that he did. I was the only reporter invited to it when he invited the ambassador of Morocco to City Hall. I think it was 1976 or 1977. And they called me up as the only Arab journalist they knew in the Midwest. They invited me. I took some photos. I wrote a story. I published it in a newspaper that I had been publishing after I got out of the Vietnam War in active duty military service, called the Middle Eastern Voice. And I got a chance to meet Richard J. Daley. But I've interviewed every mayor since Richard J. Daley, every one of them. Even Jane Byrne, who I fought with, did interviews. She came on my radio show many times. When I was at WLS, I did a radio show there for 10 years on politics and everything. But Rahm Emanuel just wouldn't talk to me. So good riddance, dude. I'm glad to see you go. Get out of here. Just remember, the pen is mightier than the sword. And the guy that has ink actually controls, you know, what history says about you. And my ink is not going to be very kind to you because you were never kind to the people that you should have been kind to. So he decides to retire. Who knows what the reasons were, but I'm just glad he's gone. And 21 candidates decide to run for office, but it gets pared down to 14. And, of course, the big names in those elections were people that hold political office, like Tony Preckwinkle, the Cook County Board President. She's not a very good Cook County Board President. You know, she's very Chicago-focused, and she's really kind of abused her power. I really see a dislike of her dislike of the suburbs. She's never been fair to the suburbs. And then there was Susana Mendoza. Now, Susana Mendoza would have been a great candidate, except I really thought she made a major mistake by relying on her soccer theme in her commercials for the majority of the campaign. It wasn't until the very, I think maybe the last 2 weeks before the election, that Susana Mendoza changed her ad and focused more on issues. You know, I didn't like her. She had kind of a squeaky voice. I think it really hurt her. She was a, you know, state controller. So she has a major, you know, function that she's going to play as a state official, handling all of the finances in the state. And then there's Bill Daley, the brother of Richard M. Daley, the son of Richard J. Daley. This guy had, I don't know, $7 million that he, you know, could tap. And I was really surprised at how bad he did. There was Jerry Joyce, the son of State Senator Jeremiah Joyce, who was part of the Daley coalition with Jane Byrne and then against Jane Byrne. There was Gary Chico, who'd run before. He was pretty sharp. I really liked Jerry Chico because his campaign focused against taxes. Paul Vallis, an education leader. Gary McCarthy, a former Chicago police chief under Rahm Emanuel, who Rahm Emanuel tanked. Bob Fioretti, the first ward alderman, I believe, and others. There were a lot of others. And then there were some new names like Lori Lightfoot, a very wealthy attorney and I guess prosecutor, very smart. Willie Wilson, who had been out there before, he was okay, but he has a big following in the African-American community. Amara Enya, who I'd never heard of before. LaShawn Ford, I'd never heard of him before. John Kozler, probably one of the youngest people to run, and Neil Sales Griffin. Now, come election time, I thought, you know, maybe Lightfoot, Preckwinkle, probably for sure, because just the weight, and Bill Daley. A lot of people thought Bill Daley was going to do better. But the big surprise was that the leading candidate was Lori Lightfoot. And Lori Lightfoot got her base up from the North Lakefront liberal movement and African Americans on the near north side of Chicago. When you look at the Tribune has a great map, by the way, of where everybody won it. And it's grouped. It was really interesting. You know, Willie Wilson had the near northwest side and much of the south and southwest side. Jeremiah Joyce got the far northwest side and the far southwest side, and probably did Bill Daley in, because Bill Daley didn't do very well on the south side at all. He did pretty well on the north side, the northwest wards, and downtown, you know, along the lakefront, near the loop. Preckwinkle pretty much did well on the south side and along the lakefront, the south side lakefront, with a very high concentration of votes. Fewer wards. I think that Willie Wilson got the most wards, but the lowest vote. And Preckwinkle got the highest, the least number of wards winning, but the highest vote. As it turned out, Lori Lightfoot, though, won with almost 92,000 votes. Tony Preckwinkle came in with 84,000. Bill Daley was only able to get 77,000. And I think that Jerry Joyce's 38,000 votes would have put Daley over the top. Probably would have given him, I'd say probably would have got most. He would have broken 20%, you know, of the vote. But Bill Daley only got about 14% of the vote. Tony Preckwinkle got 16. Lori Lightfoot got 17. Now we have the two top vote getters, Lori Lightfoot and Tony Preckwinkle, are running in the April 2nd election. It's going to be interesting to see how that pans out. But really what was significant about this election was with a lot of these candidates were good. The issues they were talking about were great. And yet, what happened in Chicago? Only 34% of the people who registered to vote actually voted. Now, you got to look at that number because it's even weaker than it sounds. 34% of the number of people who registered, and only about 60 or 70% of the people who can register to vote actually register to vote. So that 34% is like a third of the two-thirds, you know, of the people who have the right to vote but didn't register or didn't vote. That's a huge, it's probably like 20% of the city's voting age population actually voted. And that's pretty depressing. Why is that? Well, apparently there's a black flight taking place from Chicago into the suburbs. They're running from the taxes and the burdens. And I'm a little concerned because a lot of Tony Preckwinkle's base has been to oppress the suburbs, which are mostly white, and she plays to her African-American base. And she, you know, she has to kind of protect her voting block that keeps her in office. So she kind of picks on the white suburbs. And there was a lot of shenanigans in the November 2018 elections when she targeted several Cook County commissioners who successfully beat her back with her 1 cent per ounce soft drink, sweetened drink tax, which really, when you looked at it, targeted white voters who she probably didn't care if she had lost. She didn't really need them. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens in that election. But anyway, so I write about that on my website at suburbanchicagoland.com. I think that, you know, there's a lot of topics here, but every week I'm going to do this podcast and I'm going to go over, you know, my columns, my column in the Arab News on the Middle East, my column in the Middle East Monitor on the Middle East, my columns in the Southwest News newspaper group, like the Regional, the Reporter, the Des Plaines Valley News, when they decide to run my column, and also Suburban Chicagoland. And, you know, like I said, you go to my website at Hanania.com, H-A-N-A-N-I-A, Hanania. You can find me there. And you go to that website and you'll see the links to everything, including to my past podcast. Anyway, it was fun talking to you, and I know we covered a lot of area, but in the future it'll be a little more focused, but it'll give you a review of everything that's going on. Thank you, and I hope you'll join me again next week for another Ray Hanania Podcast. Have a great day, everybody. Bye-bye. This has been the Ray Hanania Podcast, a weekly overview of all my opinion columns, my radio interviews, and my reports on Middle East topics and on mainstream American politics. For more information, go to hanania.com. Thanks for listening.